Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 22nd, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Michael Schutt. Today's session number is 2004 and is titled Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, Caring for Creation from a Christian Perspective. Simpler Living, Compassionate Life. Let's listen in.
Compassionate Life. And that comes from this book that I edited, which is composed of 30 essays and 20 authors and a 12-week study guide at the back. The first day, we talked some about those two parts of the title, the simpler living, what it is, what it isn't, and compassionate life, with compassion including this rich sense of empathy and justice both. Compassion being a very powerful word, not only meaning empathy, like feeling for another, but justice, acting on behalf of others. And again, this book bringing, as Larry's previous session talked a lot about, justice for the entire Earth community, Earth including humanity, and when I say community, including non-human community in that. So, and yesterday we talked some about the abundant life and the good life. The good life as a powerful cultural idol, the pursuit and acquisition of stuff, and those things we are taught by our culture to pursue as what the good life is about. And the abundant life is modeled after Jesus and Jesus' invitation to greater freedom. Freedom from having to justify ourselves by our abilities, by our possessions and positions of power, and by how people respond to us. Freedom from those sort of things that bind us, being a characteristic of moving toward the abundant life. And that maybe being a helpful context for thinking through all the different issues that are in this book, because it goes from talking about a relationship with time and money to global economics and things like the World Trade Organization and their impact on people in the earth, and the rest of the earth, and theology and worldview, history of simplicity in Christianity, food choices, community. So all these different topics somehow relating to the good life or the abundant life, and how do they compare and contrast. And I thought today that we could go talk about some of the ways moving towards simpler living, quote unquote, might be expressed in our lives. In many ways, simpler living there's a limited view of what that involves, I think, in popular culture. It's been co-opted in many ways by Madison, by Hollywood and Madison Avenue. The marketers are now marketing simplicity. Real Simple magazine just came out recently by Time Warner. First 60 pages are essentially advertisements for simple beds that cost $4,000, you know, with simple lines to the bed, you know. So, and Honda commercials have used the word simplify. Get rid of everything else, but get a Honda, you know. And yet I have always felt that simpler living actually. And Larry's previous session, how many were at Larry's previous session just this morning? Larry, you made it. That's good. So that was you. Okay. So it was a real powerful summary, in a way, of the prophetic liberative tradition and what it might have to offer for a Christian faith that is earth-honoring and earth-inclusive. And I've always felt that simplicity actually is prophetic, or it can be. And yet, in many of the popular expressions of it today, it's limited to sort of a sense of self-help. You find the book in the self-help section on simplicity, right? It's not in the prophetic liberative, you know, social
justice section.
Of the bookstores.
No, it's in the just us section.
Right. Thank you. Just me. So.
And they call that lifestyle choices.
Yeah. Individual lifestyle choices.
Yeah.
And we've talked about, in the first day when we talked about simpler living specifically, we talked about how moving towards simpler living is not only an individual change, but it will involve the politics of simplicity. And there's a section in here on the politics of simplicity, for example. And it also how it tends to only, it can be limited to personal growth. And while that's a great thing in which we would all support, and I believe God is on the side of personal growth, personal tends to get limited in our culture to the individualism through which we see the world and the sort of skin encapsulated ego definition of self. And so I've always felt that simpler living would also call us to this compassion, which has this rich sense of empathy, justice within it. And so if that's how we're talking about simplicity, I believe it can be prophetic to these larger cultural idols, some of which we talked about yesterday. The good life being the maybe the macro idol, and underneath it, in the introduction to the book anyway, talked about economism or economic growth as an idol, and productivity. We talked specifically a little bit yesterday about productivity, not as wrong in and of itself, but wrong obviously as an idol, as a way to prove our worth and so on, and as a way to hide from listening to our own inner voice and to God's voice. So that's how, I think that simplicity can actually be very powerful and prophetic to these larger cultural idols. And both simplicity and compassion, I think, get sort of the short end of the stick a lot of times because they're not understood in a fuller way. And maybe, and then Tuesday, one other just quick comment. We did spend some time on the global economy, human economy, and nature's economy, and how obviously the global economy is contained within Earth's economy, and yet sees itself as quite separate. We hope that the Earth will take care of those externalities. We talked about externalities are essentially the things that spin off from our production line, our economic production line, like pollution would be an externality.
Tailings.
What's that?
Tailings.
Yeah. Tailings, right here, would be an externality. So a lot of people made money off of the copper, right? And a lot of jobs were provided. And
called side effects.
Yeah. And, oh yeah, by the way, there are these externalities, shoot. And even the word itself indicates how we try and treat them. They're external to the system. And we rely, again, on the circle of the earth to assimilate those externalities. But as Larry's talked about, our power now as humans has obviously exceeded the earth's ability to assimilate the results of our power, the spin-offs of our power and how we use it. Yeah, externalities. Yeah.
There are things that don't have market value, right?
Well,
like the tailings.
They can, though. I mean, we talked about how, so an externality, if you find a way, like I gave the example of installing coal scrubbers, in smokestacks. In coal burning plants, if you install a scrubber to take out more of the pollution from the smoke, that actually increases our economic growth, our gross domestic product, for example. Or I gave the example of an Exxon Valdez oil spill. In a way, that's an externality. I mean, oh shoot, we got these oil spills now. But those can actually increase GDP because you have to have people going to clean it up, and people are doing research to figure out maybe how we can stop them in the future, or at least ameliorate the effects of them. So the GDP is simply a measure of goods and services that flow through our economy.
And in that sense, dealing with the tailings ultimately will have growth in the GDP.
Exactly.
Jobs will be involved.
Even though, from the Earth's economy point of view, the tailings are a waste product that the earth is not able to assimilate.
Exactly. And the point being that GDP goes up when that's dealt with. And we just automatically, when we read the papers and we hear GDP is going up, which it obviously has been, and we're doing great, right? Good deal. That's sort of what we get. And we don't realize that isn't the economic system meant to sort of serve Earth in a sense, serve our well-being. And by our, hopefully, again, we're thinking Earth well-being. And yet we don't subtract for those things that actually decrease the well-being of Earth. And I gave examples of even divorce rates increase GDP because you have more lawyers doing more work. you have two apartments or two houses when you had one, and maybe more furniture. And so, things like the Exxon Valdez will, you know, they're not subtracted from the GDP. And so it's not a real accurate representation of what actually our sense of well-being is. And Larry pointed out how since 1957, Americans' reported sense of well-being and happiness in their lives, personally, and as families and communities, sort of, has not increased. Our sense of well-being that we report, you know, in surveys and polls has not increased since 1957. And yet, our houses have, you know, doubled in size at least. All our cars have air conditioning and stereos now, you know, da da da. Everything you look at, there's sort of been a ramp up in what we consume and what we have. So, and then we talked about how GDP and an alternative measure of economic growth or well-being, economic well-being would be this group in California developing the Genuine Progress Indicator, GPI. Genuine Progress Indicator. And so they subtract for things like the effects of Exxon Valdez oil spills. They would subtract for these external, what's trying to quantify. Admittedly, they're still working within the same system, but they're trying to get the prices right within that system, trying to quantify the costs of the power that we have now and inflict upon Earth. So that's a bit about where we've been, real quickly. And Larry's sessions have been, in a few of my sessions, we've talked some about worldviews, theologies, you know, how it is that, how we view the world, our vision in a sense, foregrounds some things and backgrounds others, literally. So that, And a lot of Larry's sessions have been pointing out how, indeed, the tradition from which all of us most likely come have tended to background nature, both as something separate from us, but also as simply a stage upon which the human drama takes place. And the stage upon which God's saving acts take place for humans only. And so that's a very powerful message about what's important and what's not. And bringing to light some of the other traditions Larry's been exploring on earth-honoring, earth-inclusive traditions within Christianity, that many, I guess, maybe all of which have been separate from the dominant Western tradition that from which we come. So, any comments so far on all that quick summary or? Yeah.
Could you tell me the meaning of GDP and GPI again? I failed it.
Yeah, this is
GDP is
gross domestic product.
Gross domestic product, okay. And GPI?
Genuine progress indicator.
Okay.
Yeah, and you'll find genuine progress indicator being put out by Redefining Progress. And there are some other folks. I mean, John Cobb and Herman Daly, I believe, in their book For the Common Good, attempted to suggest, you know, we need a different way to measure measure economic growth, or maybe we need to define it as well-being instead. And this is the most developed that I know of. Maybe there are others, but and I should point out that since these folks have, you know, gathered all this data and done analyses since 1972 or so, the early 70s, GPI, genuine progress indicator, has gone down. If you look at the graph, by the way they're measuring things, like I've said, subtracting for externalities, and of course we know the GDP is going up. That's what our politicians do, because that's what we value and what we push for. So in a sense, this GPI is a prophetic, within the prophetic tradition, standing up and saying, here is an alternative. This is what is wrong with what is, and trying to develop a structure, as Larry was talking about in the previous session, a structure for creating righteousness and justice. Anything else?
One of the thoughts that I had last night was possibly doing a word study in the Gospels on the word compassionate. Thinking when Jesus feels compassion for others and what happens around that. And I don't know if the answer is,
yeah,
I haven't done it. But my suspicion is that your issue, your desire to include justice in the concept of compassion is going to be there. I'm not sure, but my suspicion is.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. And again, that definition of compassion that I take from Frederick Buechner, and it is, I'll just repeat it again, I think it's so beautiful, it's that sometimes fatal capacity, perhaps an indication to Christ, or reference, that sometimes fatal capacity for feeling what it's like to live inside another's skin. And that's the empathy, is it not? And then he goes on, knowing there can never really be peace and joy for any until there is peace and joy finally for all. Knowing there can never really be peace and joy for any until there is peace and joy finally for all. So this all-encompassing sense of what seems to me eventually would lead to justice, to righting wrongs and so on, and standing up against what is wrong in some way. So that's partly where your comment's coming from, that definition of compassion from Buechner.
The Latin words mean to
suffer with.
Yeah, yeah.
To feel the passion.
Like the passion of our Lord, passion.
And the Greek, when it talks about Jesus responding to people, it's a Greek word which says you feel with your guts.
Your bowels.
Your bowels. You can actually, it's that kind of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hebrew word references the womb.
That does it.
The womb?
Yeah.
Now, would that be a womb with a view?
Yeah.
That's the second really bad pun of the week.
Yeah, go back to just
of the day, yeah.
It's time some of us left the
day. He's got a week left.
He's got another week. But some of us get to it.
We're leaving, yeah. Yes. We'll inflict you upon teachers next week. I'm out of here. And in some of our discussions about after some of the presentations have been, you know, so what, or how do we do this? How do we apply it in our lives? It may be meaning this simpler living, compassionate life, this movement toward justice and compassion. Or a movement toward expressing, in our own traditions, some of what Larry's been talking about in these other traditions. And so that's partly what this handout is about. Who didn't get that yet? Anyone need this?
Thank you.
Yeah, we do. Have you got no problem yet? So some of you might have a copy already. If you do, you can hand along to others. So I thought we would spend some time now brainstorming about and sharing your own stories about ways you have felt able and excited. Because I think we talked about motivation for this stuff the first session too, and how I gave the example of growing up in going to Wheaton College, which is conservative evangelical school. I tried real hard, is what it felt like. And I tried partly out of duty and obligation and guilt about what I was supposed to be and how that was not a long-term motivating factor. And nor was it one that sort of lent a sense of depth and healing in my own life. And that these things that we might talk about could become another list of do's and don'ts, kind of like a list of what you're supposed to do or not do to be a Christian, which I got real strongly at Wheaton.
I'm simpler than thou.
Yeah, and I mentioned trying to keep down with the Joneses, you know. Yeah. So, that's right. Or get down with the Joneses. So that's not, I think that's can be a difficult place or distinction to make, but a very important one. And perhaps one way to tell is if we have energy and feel something is possible in our lives, to move toward that and try that for a little while. There's a study guide at the back of the book, and often, like in the food choices, session 6, I think, is about our food choices. And there's a continuum that we describe of where we get our food, for example. And the question of the week, the suggested action step is, where are you now on the continuum, and is there a step you feel you'd like to explore? If so, try it during the next week, and then come back next week and tell us how it went. So kind of an exploratory approach, and one which would not be overwhelming to you, would be the idea. So it'd be interesting to hear from you all, and maybe just briefly I will go over these resources because I think they might spur some thoughts or questions. All right? So if you want to take a look at this sheet, here, do you need a copy? Or if you just want a copy to look at now, you can always give it back if you don't want it. Okay. So in this movement towards simplicity, one of the things I talked about day one was developing supportive community, that we're not able to do this on our own, partly because it's swimming against dominant cultural messages in so many ways, including those we get in our church often. So to develop supportive community, and I've listed some ways, some resources that might help you do that, one of which is the study guide in this book, 12 weeks of stuff you can go through, or 12 months, however you want to do it, or if you only have 6 weeks, there are suggestions on how many weeks you might want to do something together. But again, all these with the idea that the authorities in the room are not sort of the voices from this book, for example. They're simply authors, other voices that are in the room with you, and your voice is just as valid and offering of wisdom to the group. So all of these would, in a sense, try and create community for you all to continue to support each other as you move on, even after you stop meeting together. Although some groups continue to meet going through other guides after they've gone through this one, for example. And the other thing about a lot of these ones I've listed is that the role of facilitator, for example, rotates. So not one person has to take on the lead, you know? And lots of time, most of the time, lay people call the group together and pastors do or don't come. It can be very sort of low-key in the sense of the amount of time one person has to put into facilitating the group. I've mentioned the next one, New Roadmap Foundation, Your Money or Your Life, particularly working with time and money issues, is a real helpful resource. And they have a 6-week study guide for Christians as well. And I've put down where you can order that study guide. Cecile Andrews' book, The Circle of Simplicity, also has a study guide that's very similar to the one in here in terms of role facilitator rotates, very non-hierarchical and so on, really valuing where you're coming from and starting from your own story. So the next one is volunteer for an organization or for social justice, for ecological restoration, so on. And what I've said next is such experiences put us in contact with the other, quote unquote. And so this isn't a to-do list again. And maybe the first thing some of us need to do is begin to peel, you know, say no to some things and open up our life a bit to get in touch with what we feel passionately about and then re-enter somewhere instead of just being so busy all the time. But I've alluded to stories, experiences I've had with homeless men, with aspen trees, with wolves, sort of the other. I mean, I've never been homeless. Most of the men I was working with were of another race and twice my age and addicted to alcohol and so on. And I had never been addicted, and I was from Minnesota and white and young. I was 22, and you know, when I was living with these men. And moments of grace came when, in a sense, the sense of separation between myself and others broke down. And that's happened with aspen trees and wolves as well. The most obvious stories for me in my life anyway. And for those of you who went on the hike Wednesday, I read the story of the aspen trees. So I think the grace, you know, the gift of that breakdown, that sense of separation, was a gift of grace. But what I did was sort of to put myself in position to be in that uncomfortable relationship. And so that's sort of what this is suggesting, is that those opportunities to put ourselves in relationship with the other can sort of expand our sense of or develop our sense of compassion, perhaps. So that's why that's there. And then see all these different ways we vote with your ballot, obviously, with your wallet, by supporting local businesses, with your voice, writing letters, with your feet, protesting the WTO, if that's what you feel called, you know, passionately about, or, you know, where do your feet take you, in a sense, is a vote. Just examples of that.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Is there a good resource for investing if you are interested in investing in the industry or?
Thank you. That's actually under vote, under with your wallet. Invest in socially and environmentally responsible ways. Mm-hmm. The Green Money Journal. And their website's there and their phone number. But I mean, there are a lot, to answer your question. Domini, Parnassus, Calvert are some of the big ones.
Pax funds.
Working assets.
Local service.
Yeah, Domini, Parnassus. These are just some names, but you could find reference to probably all of them in the Green Money Journal.
Okay.
Those are all mutual funds.
That's true. Yeah.
Working assets is telephone.
Yeah, working
it's
assets.
Telephone service.
Working assets
long
is where the credit card that accumulates the profits, or you vote at the end of the year to which organizations it goes to.
Oh.
So instead of like getting your airline miles or your Chevrolet money piling up, it all goes to charity at the end.
Mm.
Different, actually very good ones.
And this year, if you join working assets, they give you free coupons for Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
One a month. Man, now that's something to consider.
That's an incentive.
Even
though they've sold out, though?
Yeah, they've sold to it. They've been bought out, yeah.
Part of the contract that has to continue.
The D is consider food choices, and I mean, you come to Holden, and that's an obvious theme here, just in what you eat every day. That's generally very low in the food chain, not a lot of meat up here. We had a food forum, there was a Vespers about food. In the discussion on the economics, the circle of Earth's economy and the line of our human economy, one of the most everyday ways that we can begin to reflect more of a circle in our food is in our food choices, as opposed to the you know, production line of agribusiness. And so we could talk about that more if you like, but again, this resource could be very helpful in that. It's called Food, Faith, and Sustainability that Earth Ministry put out.
Where's that available?
Right now, right here, or you could contact Earth Ministry, which I'm not even sure I put our own organization on here, actually.
Your phone number is under Food, Faith, and Sustainability.
Yeah, our phone number is on there somewhere on this. But we also, Earth Ministry also has a website, earthministry.org, and we also have all this stuff over here, and you can get on our mailing list if you'd like, just to get our mini journal called Earth Letter. Now, there's this great, pretty new organization called the Center for a New American Dream. In a way, one way to characterize the good life is it's the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. And so this place is developing, or they're saying, we need a new dream, a new American dream. It's the Center for a New American Dream. They've got a lot of great resources, and I've listed their how to contact them. And actually, they now have, they're developing a program to reach out to faith-based communities. It's brand new. We talked about it at lunch yesterday. And I'm going to apply for that job, dagnabbit. Because it's brand new, and I hope to get the job. So maybe I'll see some of you in a different context. But
did you move to Tacoma Park, Maryland?
No, I would stay in Seattle, hopefully.
Stay in Seattle.
Yeah. But their mission is to shift and reduce consumption to enhance quality of life for environmental reasons, for environmental justice, and to engender social justice. So they've really done a good job of recognizing the first part, enhancing quality of life, recognizing that in a sense the American dream is not providing us what we really want, and so raising that, and also just pointing out that we're not reporting we're happier than we, you know, since 1957. But then also they're doing it because of their concern for ecological and social justice. So it's a good group. And they've got a good website, actually. And then just F is a list of resources, the first one being Affluenza, which was actually shown here this week. A really dynamic, fun, humorous way of looking at the costs of consumerism on people in the rest of the earth. There's a study guide that can go with it. There's ways to get in touch with ordering that. We've already talked about my book a fair amount. And then Food, Faith, and Sustainability is listed there. And again, phone numbers for how to get these things. And just interestingly, there's also a couple different resources around. It's the Eco Church and Action Manual. There are others as well. And the ELCA may have, I don't know if they do yet, like a Greening Congregations manual, let's say. But in a sense,
Joel Ebenezer has some of that.
Some of those resources.
Especially on energy use.
Yeah.
By local churches, by the institutional.
Right, by your church building.
Yeah.
Your heating, your lighting, your use of the grounds, how do you fertilize your lawn, you know. But also, Eco Church in Action Manual does a worship audit, too. It sort of has, yeah, you know, and your educational audit, you know, looking at, again, what are the messages you're getting from the pulpit? What's being foregrounded, what's being backgrounded, and also in your Sunday school classes. So there's this, that's one of the reasons I like Eco Church and Action Manuals, that it does have this holistic perspective that the ways in which we heat and light and fertilize and so on, and are affected by what we hear, by the worldview that gets defined for us. And so there's this way to audit more than just simply your energy use, for example. And they're fairly simple and perhaps rudimentary, but it's a way to start the conversations. Earth Ministry is also developing a Greening Congregations resource, and it will be done fairly soon. I don't know. I haven't heard the latest, but you could contact us and ask us where we're at on that. It'll be a real helpful resource for this greening of congregations in a holistic way.
North side of our roof is pretty green already.
You got a lot of moss there. Yeah, nice.
So that's common. So I think of a church where we don't talk much about this kind of stuff, so we think that would be a good starting place not to drop people's world a little too abruptly.
You mean Eco Church and Action Manual?
To kind of, I think we have a new pastor who's going to be real receptive to doing more adult ministry. I mean, but I'm a little afraid of coming down too hard and kind of crushing it off as too radical.
Well, I think it would depend partly on your sense of others in the church that might be supportive of you. Or, in other words, another place to start might be to just increase dialogue for a little while by doing one of these courses I've seen, you know, one of these books or some way to get a group together. Maybe it's a Sunday school class this fall or something that will begin to talk about relationship with the rest of the earth in a Christian, in a church context, and to have a resource that might help you do that and kind of help create community around it. And so then people who even aren't in the class kind of know that's going on in the parish. And then to continue that with, okay, what might we do now? Well, there's these resources that might help us look at how we're heating and lighting, let's say. And I mean, you actually end up, and Job has some real good stuff on this, I think. You know, the money you save eventually by installing these more efficient lighting sources, let's say.
Right.
So there's an economic incentive as well for churches to be doing this. But it's nice if you can put it almost in a liturgical, you know, framework, a liturgical, theological framework for, have a celebration for putting in the light bulb or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's my suggestion, maybe, is to, unless you feel
is
like you...
study guide or not so much?
It's not so much a study guide as you go through some things together as a group.
Maybe the next step after maybe a smaller group, getting a conversation.
That's a possibility I would suggest, yeah. Unless you feel ready to go at it and start. See, some people people learn differently and feel psyched about doing different things, and some might be really, let's go, let's do some things like this right away.
Yeah.
Others might kind of want to spend some time getting to know one another, thinking about sort of their theology and worldview and how it might relate to this. And so I think it partly depends on, and I think you'll have both in your group no matter what you do. So it could be something that could continue one way or the other.
Speaking as a pastor, if you find 8 people that want to do anything with you,
yeah,
you know,
success.
Just go to your pastor and say, we want to do this, or, you know, can you find resources or whatever. But if you can find the people to do it,
Guaranteed. Larry?
I also think it's important to realize we don't have to convert everybody to a particular worldview in order to do this. There will be some people, they just want to save the church some money.
Yeah.
You know, and don't care particularly care what way you do it. If you've got a better mousetrap, better lighting system, better energy use, you got other folks who their way of serving is to actually carry it out, do it. They don't have to be in favor of simpler living before they're ready to rewire, you know, this or do a job on the plumbing. And glad to be asked and to be a part of a collective effort instead of just being on their own and complaining about it.
Yeah, it's really good.
Well, not only that, some of these ideas then will slop over into the private life of these people and create you an advantage for them also.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Personal.
Knowing my congregation, I'd say that the majority of our folks are very much part of the dominant cultural religion and are very me-centered and are wanting the good life, thinking of that's where happiness is. So in terms of starting an educational process in the church, I would start with money issues in my congregation, because that's where I think most people are feeling the tightest pinch in my congregation. So I might start with something fun like Affluenza, the video. And it's just a couple of sessions, so it's not a big time commitment. You know. And try to open the door there, and then, because my remembrance of the video, it's been a couple of years since I've seen it, is that it sort of ends up opening up the whole issue of the externalities you were talking about, and priorities, and contentment in life.
Yeah, it does. It does a good job of bringing in a lot of different aspects that, in a sense, the book does by saying simpler living or whatever, affluenza. There are many parts to it. Yeah. And often in your own parishes, the felt needs of people, of all of us, often are what draws us to consider some of these things are time and money. And that's why the book starts out with time and money stuff. And then you, other connections can be made. But the important point is to kind of start where people are and value where they are. And sort of, and that actually the first session in this book, Simpler Living, Compassionate Life, is called The Sacred Journey. You tell your own story the first time you get together, and you read an essay by Frederick Buechner called The Sacred Journey, where he attempts to listen to his life for whatever of meaning of holiness of God there is in it to hear. And so that, I feel that's a very important place to begin.
I like what you were saying about kind of allowing people to contribute or participate or be involved in their own way and not sort of having a vision that everyone needs to come as one.
Yes. You're a little group of eight.
Yeah.
Might be a way of getting a vision for the congregation. But the actual strategy of getting something done doesn't require that people join your group or believe.
I think of my mom as like the perfect example of her father grew up in the Depression, and she is the most penny-pinching person I know. I'm cutting the toothpaste tube so you can get the very last bit. I know she's not doing it from a caring for the earth point, but she's the most probably ecologically friendly person I know, purely for sort of that scarcity place she came from growing up. And so I learned a lot from her, and yet she comes at it from a different angle. So.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, Chuck wanted to.
I put on the board in green, it's very hard to read, the name and toll-free number for Job Ebenezer, who is the ELCA's person for environmental stewardship, based in Chicago, and he works full-time on resources for congregations, mainly, individuals as well, households, but mainly congregations on environmental stewardship. Everything from urban garden things that congregations can do to how to reduce their energy costs in the parish.
Yeah.
And it's 800-638-3522. And his name is the biblical Job and the biblical Ebenezer. He's from India. He's an Indian and a very good resource. Another that occurs to me in this connection is the Lutheran World Relief Coffee Project. You know about that? Equal Exchange? Congregations buying coffee through Equal Exchange directly from the producers in various parts of the world. Tanzania, Costa Rica, yeah. Colombia, wherever you want to get it from. And not only do the producers get more money for their product because they sell without the middle people, they sell directly to the retail consumer. They also get a portion of it for the coffee co-op, for the cooperative of growers to work on development projects.
Yeah.
And it's a very good venture, and I think now about 1,500 to 2,000 ELCA congregations alone are participating in that, buying their coffee that way for consumption within the parish.
And that's called the
Equal Exchange, but the way to get in touch with them is Lutheran World Relief. And what is their number in Baltimore? I'll have to
You can always ask Joe, too. And I should point out for those of you who aren't Lutheran and would like to know about your congregational resources, the National Council of Churches has an eco-justice working group, and Joe Ebenezer is a member of that. If you're a Presbyterian, Bill Simplatsky-Jarman is a member of that. So that most every mainline and the evangelicals have an evangelical environmental network.
Yeah.
So there are places to go denominationally and sort of hierarchically to get things that could be helpful to you in addition to things I've listed here.
We should, in that connection, mention ICCR, mm-hmm. Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, 475 Riverside Drive, New York, 10027. And it's coming back in part to the investment question, but it's not only about investments. And I think to pay attention to investments now is so important because the flow of global finance structures so much of the injustice as well as the potential justice in the world. There just isn't any other factor quite as huge as the movement of money around. And the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility is the church's pan-church monitoring group of corporations and their behavior. And it includes issues of investment at many different levels. There's investments in the sense of stocks and bonds. So churches are represented by their members on ICCR to see where churches want to, like the ELCA, but you can do it with your congregation, where the churches want to put their money. You know, social screens, what are good investments? You were named Domini and others. But in terms of investments in corporations, too. And then as a stockholder, you can file resolutions about what the corporation ought to be doing. And it, then the management has to respond to your resolution. Now, they can say, we don't accept it. But then it goes to the stockholder meeting, and there's a vote. So then you've got a public forum to say, we should, the corporation should be doing this and stop doing that, et cetera. So it's a, it's an extraordinary device for an issue by means of a direct relationship with the corporation because you're a stock, stockholder. So, and then the ICCR also has a whole division of community investment focused on small businesses, inner city, et cetera, as a way of channeling funds, and churches can participate in that by way of congregation, by way of push your own denomination. Where is the ELCA's pension fund for the pastor? Where is that money going? Where is it being invested? All of those kinds of questions are important ones, and you can get at it by information from Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility. 475 Riverside Drive.
475 Riverside Drive.
I'm sure they do, and I don't know what it is. It's probably www.iccr.org. But I wouldn't guarantee that. That's a guess.
I can do a search.
I have a suggestion.
I'll put the rest of the address.
Thank you. That we break up for 5 minutes into groups of either two or three, and you can just to talk with someone, because not everyone gets to talk here this morning publicly, about something you feel, something you've done that's been useful to you in expressing some of these sort, this sort of ethos in your own life or in your congregation, or if you don't, you know, if you feel overwhelmed by it, just wherever you're at. Or share an idea with your mates there. And we'll come back in 5 minutes. So it's about time to close.
Could I just say a word about the LWR number?
Oh yeah, let's listen up for this number here.
The coffee effort that I talked about, Equal Exchange, which serves others than Lutherans. I mean, they're based in Massachusetts and they serve number of denominations and other groups. But the LWR 800 number, where you can get information on Equal Exchange, you can ask for materials about it, order forms and so on, is 800-LWR-LWR-2. And you get a human being when you call that number.
All right. Now, so 800-LWR-LWR-2. Now, thought it'd be interesting to some of you who might have not spoken yet, if you would like to give us your 2 cents worth or whatever. Yes.
Michael, we were talking, because I think one of the hardest audiences that we haven't addressed is the family with teenage children. Mm-hmm. And how you live as a family, especially uh-huh. These two couples live in areas that don't have farmers markets and don't have access in the Southwest and in Dallas area. And how do you get children into this? They get some of it at school, but this is, and working families.
Yeah.
It's no small fair tell you're taking not to shop at the Gap and Home Depot. I mean, that, yeah. It's easy if you're single and you have a push.
Sure.
It is hard to tell your 11-year-old not shopping there.
Yes.
All our friends are shopping there.
Yeah. I don't know. we have some resources. We have a handout called Youth Resources or something like that over here, and also this Center for New American Dream has a kids in commercialism portion of what they are doing. So they have resources specifically focused on living with kids in this consumer culture.
I would think that Affluenza video would be a good place to start. I know when we were watching the other day, we went, oh yeah, that's something our youth could
Yeah, it's certainly appropriate for young teens to older teens, yeah.
Washington, North Idaho Conference Net Church of Christ did a retreat for teenagers around using Affluenza in the video as its theme. So it would be something you wouldn't have to reinvent.
One of the things that Affluenza does have in there is two people, these two girls, I think they were like 16 or 17, did this award-winning play on Barbie. And they really struck a chord on sort of the messages they get as teenagers. And that they show a fair amount of that and talk to those two girls in the video, a fair amount. So that and the Center for New American Dream are the two that I know of that are most focused on addressing that very difficult question.
But what about the eating, you know, or everything, vegetables or the serious aversion?
Yeah, I mean, there are perhaps, I don't know if you have stores in the area that maybe carry an option of organic, but, you know, maybe not. I know there are certain parts of the country where that sort of ethos has not had as much effect yet,
right.
Or political movement. And so that's partly, it's a good question, partly because, you know, there's individual change that we've talked about some in moving towards simplicity, but there's also this politics of simplicity, this position we are sometimes put in, whether we're really supportive of it or not, that doesn't allow us to have access to those things that might express our values more closely. Or we're not making enough money to afford something we'd like to be able to afford or something. So it points to perhaps in, you mentioning Texas or Dallas or something, maybe there's, and if you feel you can do, energize about that issue, food issue, maybe there's a group to tap into that would express that sort of political change that would need to happen or policy change that would make it possible to have a farmer's market in a few places in the area, for example. Or, so maybe there's an organization that way, or an organizational way to express this movement towards simplicity.
Well, I was also thinking we talked about adolescents, but that probably dealing with food and clothes is not the place to start with them because it's too culturally embedded. But on the other hand,
too much peer pressure.
Yeah, but the kids have a lot of identity with nature and animals and that kind of stuff, and maybe come in that direction.
And see, when you're in the Southwest, there's not a lot of that. You know, we live in Phoenix, and you know, we don't have greenness and you know, this kind of
desert.
Yeah, well, we have very desolate, and I mean the fruits and vegetables that we get are just gross.
There's other classes where they're A, B, C, and D or something. I'm with Casper. Wow, we get like class C and D.
My challenge by starting a class in hydroponics or something like that on a small scale. Mm-hmm. Or take an old tire, everybody, and fill it up with some earth that you can buy in a plant, a store, you know, and plant your own vegetables. And you can water that amount and see, you get an amazing amount of stuff out of one tire.
Worth the soil, huh?
With topsoil. With topsoil.
Yeah, you need some soil in there, right?
You need to pull some weeds.
Well, we were in Colorado visiting my son and his wife, and they said they pointed out their garden, which is really blooming. And they said, well, they discovered Mayan-style cooking. And they said, you know, the Mayans had such hard earth that they dig one hole, and in it they put corn and beans and squash. I mean, seeds for all of them. And so that their garden is thriving. But it's also something out of that tire. I mean, that kids can watch, because it will come up and it will be, it's not a major project, but it is a good project to watch. Eat it.
Well, the EOCA headquarters, I saw this in, I think, the Lutheran magazine, has big truck tires or tractor tires.
And they have pools, too.
On top of
plastic
their,
pools.
Yeah,
pools.
On top of their
top of the parking ramp.
Building. And they've been growing stuff ever since they opened that.
Yeah, and Joe Ebenezer works with that project, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing I've noticed, people being, in terms of addressing teenagers and so on, is I think they're very aware of this just incredible marketing push at them, and that to be defined is to be this, and they're savvy enough to sort of, you know, to ask them to reflect with you about that, you know, defined by what you have, and also there is at least a bit more of an awareness of environmental issues now in the schools and so on, and so to make to and they're aware of these connections. And to begin the dialogue there, I they do some of that in the affluenza video as well, showing people talking about the effects of sort of marketing on them as teenagers. Now, is there any other hot idea that someone has that they just have to share before we go to lunch? If that came out of your small group.
I think that's a good hot idea.
Good hot idea. Going to lunch?
If you go to thrift stores, you can find the Gap label.
Yeah, we do that a lot. I mean, or ask them, what really works well is saying, if you really want it, you can buy it yourself. That never seems to get bought. So where we go, we get all the at garage sales. They're, you know, who probably has, you know, a teenage career, his whole teenage years, he can just pick a shirt out. Because you get them for, you know, a dollar.
Mm-hmm. Certain stores are a good thing on many levels. They not only reuse material, used material, but they raise money usually for a social good, a social cause. That's who sets them up. And they're less expensive. I mean, you can get a lot of good stuff cheaply.
Yeah, Quetzal, you're 18, right?
I'm 18.
Do you have any, before we go to Larry and close, do you have anything to offer this sort of, this question about being a teenager and what's sort of given, sold to you, sort of?
That's a good question. In fact, I was talking to him a little bit about it, about how exactly how it's all over TV, it's all over music, everything. It's all about overconsumption in this country, you know. You know, you watch a video and then somebody's got a Mercedes car with a gold watch and cash flying out of everywhere. And I think you just have to make your kid aware of what is going on, you know what I mean? And as far as where I've been, you know, I've traveled, I've seen other countries, I've been to third world countries, I've lived there. And when you really get exposed to that, you really get a sense of what is going on and as far as world economy. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of kids, they don't see that. They don't even know about that. They don't realize that because they're just seeing what's around them. And mm-hmm. you know, to some kids, it's so important. What is it? The newest fad? What is the brand new shoes? What is the clothes it's in? You know, regardless of how expensive it is, how much of a burden it is for the parents to afford it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you just approach your child about that and talk to them and make them, you know, realize a lot of things, you know what I mean? And it's, and even, it could work against, you know, I heard you guys, a few of you guys say peer pressure, you know, by educating your kid and by him educating more of his friends, you know, there, that right there reverses the cycle of peer pressure. You got a whole
group
going against, you know, this whole consumption, you know, because, you know, I know for, you know, that has worked as far as my perspective, because I have a lot of friends who are doing exactly what I'm talking about, you know what I mean, over-consuming, who feel that that you need to have a car to be cool, that you need to have, you know, money to be cool, but, you know, they got to realize that there's more to that, you know.
And also the music that everybody is listening to in that age group is just horrendous. That's like the thing that just...
Well, Quetzal's making good music.
All the music that's going out there is just for buying. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not quality. It's quantity. You know what I mean? It's like all the latest pop artists out there. They're just putting out albums for consumption, not for art or any musical real purpose. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They know that they put that album out there, it's gonna be number one, it's gonna be selling, because every single kid out there wants it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think if you make your child aware of what is going on and how, you know, by them partaking in this, they're just, you know, basically, you know, kind of feeding this whole thing.
Right.
Well, thank you, Quetzal. Larry, you had something earlier? No, okay. Well, it's almost time for lunch, so let's have a closing moment of silence and prayer before we go. Thank you, Creator, for time at Holden and for the beautiful mountains all around us and the stream. We ask for your presence with us as we seek to live in a celebrative, joyful way that expresses our love for all that is. In your name, amen.
Amen.
Thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Have a nice week.
Thank you.